So in this talk, I'll be discussing under constrained symbolic execution, which was work I did during my PhD with Dawson Engler at Stanford. So the two main contributions of this paper are a technique and a tool for finding deep bugs in real open source C and C++ code. This technique requires very little manual effort on the part of users, and in particular, it requires no manual test cases, nor does it require any kind of full functional specification to be given. Now, the types of bugs that this technique finds may have security implications. It does not specifically identify the bugs that are remotely exploitable. The actual exploitability has to be determined manually. And then the types of bugs that we can find are memory access errors, heap management errors, assertion failures, and divisions by zero. And using our tool based on this technique, we found 77 new bugs in Bind, OpenSSL, and Linux kernel, including two OpenSSL denial of service vulnerabilities for which advisories were issued. We also found 14 Linux kernel vulnerabilities, most of which were relatively minor DOS issues. So current practice for preventing bugs from reaching end users falls roughly into four categories. There's code reviews, there's safer languages such as Java that try to avoid some of the more error-prone language constructs such as pointers. There's traditional manual regression testing, and then there's a variety of static analysis tools such as Coverity and the Clang Static Analyzer. However, despite all of these techniques, bugs are still everywhere. One of the techniques that has shown some promise in finding the types of bugs that are missed by those other techniques is symbolic execution. And the idea with symbolic execution is to provide symbolic inputs to a program rather than a single set of concrete inputs, and to conceptually consider all possible execution paths through a program and all possible input values. And tools that are based on symbolic execution tend to accurately track all memory state up to bit precision, and they don't use any form of abstraction usually. And then a tool will report any paths that might crash with certain input values, along with specific concrete examples of those input values that can be used offline as test cases to reproduce the crashes and then find and fix the bugs. And our work builds upon the CLI tool, which is prior work from OSDI in 2008. So here's a simple example of how symbolic execution works. Here we have this function foo that takes in a single integer argument x. And let's say that there's some program running through a symbolic execution tool, and it calls this function foo with a symbolic input x. And so the symbolic input x represents any possible input value that's representable as a 32-bit integer. So the tool begins executing this function, and the first statement is this if statement. And here we're comparing x against 0. And so since x is a symbolic value, it might be 0, it might be non-zero, rather than choosing either the true or false branches, the tool conceptually forks execution and considers both paths. So on the left-hand side here, we have the case where x is non-zero. This is the true branch. And the next statement that gets executed is this division operation, x over 10. Anytime we have a division operation, the tool has to check the denominator to see if it could be zero, since that would trigger a floating point exception and crash the program. So the tool looks at this division operation. It says, can 10 be zero? Well, no, 10 is a constant value, it's non-zero. So this division operation is okay. And so on that path, we return from the function. Now let's consider the other path, where x is equal to zero. This is the else branch. So once again, we have a division operation here. This time it's 10 over x, and the tool looks and says, can x be zero? Well, it turns out along this path, x has to be zero. So anytime we have this division operation, we will always have a division by zero. So along this path, the tool will report an error to the user along with a concrete test case where x has the value zero, and then we'll terminate this path and only continue exploring the paths that did not crash. So the main problem in symbolic execution is scalability. It suffers from the well-known path explosion problem, since the number of distinct execution paths through a program is roughly exponential in the number of if statements that are executed. It also suffers from issues of individual path length and complexity, and in particular, if paths are infinite, then it runs right into the halting problem, and then it becomes undecidable. And then finally, symbolic execution tools tend to depend on very expensive SMT queries for a lot of their functionality, and they tend to spend a large percentage of their execution time waiting for these queries to be satisfied. So the solution we propose in this paper is under-constrained symbolic execution. And the idea here is to directly execute individual functions within a program rather than running the whole program starting at main. And the goal is that if we're running less code, then hopefully we're exploring fewer paths and also shorter and less complex paths. Now, when I say we are running individual functions within a program, we do actually follow function calls. So you start your execution somewhere within a program at some function boundary, but if that function calls another function, we do actually follow that function. We just don't start at main, we start at any function within the program. And using this technique, we're able to directly test previously unreachable code that a tool could not get to when you started at main. But this technique does introduce two main challenges. The first is that unlike whole programs that typically take untyped byte arrays as input, either from file descriptors or command line arguments, functions within a program take complex inputs often. These might be pointers to linked lists or trees. And the second major challenge is when you're calling a function within a program, those functions tend to have some set of preconditions. For example, pointer argument maybe can't be null. And since one of our goals was not to require much effort on the part of users, we simply don't know what these preconditions are. So when our tool explores paths that violate these preconditions and any errors that it finds and reports to the user constitute false positives. So that's the second challenge. So in this paper, we talk about our implementation that we call the UC CLI tool, which extends the CLI tool. It runs LLVM bitcode that's compiled from C and C++ source, and it automatically synthesizes these complex inputs to each function using a technique that's based on lazy initialization. And lazy initialization was also previously used in Java Pathfinder, which is a Java-based symbolic execution tool. However, unlike Java, C and C++ support arbitrary typecasting and pointer manipulation, which introduced significant complexity in terms of how we had to implement lazy initialization and do all sorts of pointer tracking. Our tool also accepts a user-specified input depth limit that bounds the sort of the depth of each data structure. So for a linked list, that would be the length of the linked list. For a tree, it would be the height of the tree. And in the literature, that's called k-bounding. So lazy initialization works by initially considering all inputs as being in this unbound state. And with C and C++, we don't know ahead of time which input values actually are pointers because anything could be cast to a pointer. So we conservatively say anything might be a pointer, and we initialize it to this unbound state. And then the first time we dereference a symbolic unbound pointer, we allocate a new object to satisfy this dereference. We then bind the symbolic pointer to the new object by adding a path constraint that symbolic value is equal to the address of the new object that we just allocated. Now, here we assume we make an explicit assumption that there's no aliasing. We could consider cases where that unbound pointer maps to existing objects, but for the workloads we looked at, they didn't really use cyclical data structures, and this added more false positives than it did sort of improve the analysis. But depending on your workload, you might want to make a different decision here. And then on subsequent dereferences, once we've already dereferenced it previously, we ensure that that same symbolic pointer maps to that same original object that was allocated the first time that pointer was dereferenced. So here's a simple example of how lazy initialization works. Here we have this function listSum that accepts a pointer to the head of a linked list and then returns the sum of the elements in that linked list. So our tool will run listSum with some symbolic pointer n that's initially in this unbound state. So the first statement that gets executed is initializing sum here. Nothing special happens. So now we get to the head of this while loop. And here we're comparing the symbolic value n against 0. And so just like in the earlier example, instead of choosing either the true or false branches, we fork execution and consider both. On the top here, we have the case where n is equal to 0. And along that path, we don't enter the loop. We simply return 0. That effectively represents a linked list of length 0. So let's look at the other path now that actually enters the while loop where n is non-zero. So the next statement that gets executed is this dereference of n. We're reading this val field from n. Since n is an unbound symbolic pointer, the tool allocates a new object to satisfy the dereference. And let's call that new object UC node 1, UC for under constrained. So this allocates some new memory that represents UC node 1. And the state of that memory is itself initialized to this unbound state. Because you may want to dereference, as you'll see in a moment, pointers from within this object. And initializing these new objects to an unbound state allows us to sort of recursively build these data structures. That's sort of the key to how lazy initialization works. So the next statement is dereferencing n again. Since this is not the first time we've dereferenced n, it will map to that same object, UC node 1, and read the next field from within that object and set n to that value. So now we get back to the head of the while loop, and now we're comparing the current value of n against 0. Since n holds this next field from UC node 1, which is an unbound symbolic pointer, we don't know anything about it, so we fork execution once again. And so in this middle case here, we have UC node 1.next being equal to 0, and along that path we'll break out of the while loop, and this effectively tests a linked list of length 1. Along the other path, where n is non-zero, we enter the loop once again. And so the next statement that gets executed is this dereference of the current value of n. Since n is, yet again, an unbound symbolic pointer, we allocate a new object to satisfy this dereference that we call UC node 2. And so now we've allocated the second element in this linked list. And so the same process will continue essentially indefinitely until we reach this user-specified input depth limit. Let's assume that the user specified a depth limit of 2, and then we'll break out of the while loop after a linked list of length 2. So in this paper, we consider two use cases for under-constrained symbolic execution. The first is equivalence checking in the context of patches. And here the goal is that we're comparing yesterday's code against today's code, and hopefully today's code has fewer bugs than yesterday's code. Or at the very least, hopefully we haven't introduced any new bugs by applying patches to yesterday's code. And there are other use cases for equivalence checking that we explored in a previous paper from CAF 2011. The second use case we look at in this paper is general bug finding in the context of these rule-based checkers that we added on top of symbolic execution. And here we're not looking at two versions of a function. We're simply looking at one function in isolation and looking for specific types of bugs. And we wrote checkers to find memory leaks, uses of uninitialized data, and unsafe uses of user input that we ran on top of our tool. And our tool provides a simple interface for adding new checkers. So the basic idea behind equivalence checking is that you run two versions of a function and you assert that their outputs are equivalent. There's really two components to this. The first is value equivalence, where you ensure that the return value, any arguments passed by reference, global static variables, as well as any system call effects are all identical after running the two versions of the function with the same set of inputs. The second component is what we call error or crash equivalence. And so when you're looking at two versions of a function, as I mentioned, we don't know what the preconditions are to these functions, but because they're two versions of the same function, we can make the simplifying assumption that they have the same set of preconditions. So if you feed a particular input value to both of these functions and they both crash, we assume that that's not a bug in the function, that that's an invalid input value that violates these preconditions. And so we simply discard those paths and we don't report an error to the user if both versions of the function crash. So we're looking for more interesting paths where one version of the function crashes and the other doesn't, given the same input. And for the use case that we look at in this paper, we actually discard value equivalence altogether. We're only looking for cases where the version of a function after a patch is applied crashes, but the old version did not on the same input, since this sounds like a new bug that was introduced by that patch. When our tool is doing equivalence checking, it's actually verifying equivalence on a per-path basis with the same set of symbolic inputs. And if it manages to exhaust all paths through the two versions of the function, then it has effectively verified that the two functions are equivalent up to the given input bound and with certain caveats that we discussed in the paper. So this is a stronger guarantee than you can get from most sort of static analysis tools that use abstraction. We evaluated our tool on Bind and OpenSSL, which are two mature security critical code bases, each of around 400,000 lines of code. We looked at 487 patches from Bind and 324 patches from OpenSSL, and we ran our tool for an hour on each of these patched functions. We discovered 10 new bugs, 4 in Bind and 6 in OpenSSL, including, as I mentioned, 2 OpenSSL denial of service vulnerabilities. We also verified that 67 functions from Bind and 48 functions from OpenSSL did not have any new crashes introduced to them by their respective patches. And these are subject to, as I mentioned, certain caveats that we discussed in the paper. And here we used a maximum input size of 25 kilobytes, which is a fairly substantial input size for these types of tools. Here's an example of one of the bugs that we found. That was one of the security advisories that were issued. Here we have this do SSL 3 write function that's responsible for sending an SSL message. And the first thing it does on line 1 is check whether this write buffer has been allocated. And if this write buffer is null, then on line 2, it goes ahead and allocates that write buffer. On line 6, the code checks to see if there's an SSL alert pending. And if so, it needs to send this alert message before it can send the original message that we're trying to send with this function call. And so on line 7, it goes ahead and sends this alert. But this SSL dispatch alert function has this subtle side effect of freeing the write buffer, even though we checked it on line one. So along this path, when execution gets down to line 14, we get a null pointer dereference. Now this bug occurs along an uncommon code path. Two things have to happen. First, you have to be using this SSL mode release buffers runtime option that causes that function to go ahead and free that write buffer. But it turns out that this option is fairly widely used, including in Apache mod SSL. And also an SSL alert has to be pending. And it's these sorts of cases where you have two seemingly unrelated conditions having to happen simultaneously where manual regression testing tends to fail. Humans are very bad at thinking, should I write a test case in which these two completely unrelated things happen simultaneously because there might be a bug? Symbolic execution tends to excel at these sorts of things where it compares just arbitrary combinations of circumstances that might happen simultaneously. So as I mentioned earlier, inputs to a function typically have some set of preconditions, and those are unknown to our tool. So we looked at two partial solutions in this paper. The first is a set of automated heuristics that we describe, and there's also an option to add manual annotations that the user can write. And so this is in contrast to other techniques such as model checking, where before you run the tool at all, you have to write some full specification about what the function is supposed to be doing. With our tool, initially you write nothing, and then on the back end, once it's started to report false positives, you can silence these sort of as you go if there's large numbers of them. And we found that in practice, simple annotations can actually silence many errors. And here's one example. Here we have this ISC region compare function from bind, and this is comparing two regions of memory. And a region of memory is just a base pointer and a length. And our tool doesn't know that this base pointer and this length have anything to do with each other. So on line 8, the code correctly chooses the minimum length of the two buffers that it's comparing and passes that minimum length to memcomp on line 10. And so there's no error here, but our tool reported many false positives within memcomp where it thought that the code may have been reading these buffers out of bounds. So we wrote a simple one-line annotation here, this invariant that the length of the buffer is less than or equal to the size of the object pointed to by the base field. And this one line was able to silence 623 errors, which was 7.5% of all the errors that our tool reported for bind. And so total, we wrote about 400 lines of manual annotations for bind and about 60 lines for OpenSSL, which we felt was reasonable effort given the sizes of the code bases and their relative importance. The other use case that we look at in this paper that I won't go into too much detail, but it's described in the paper, is this general bug finding where we look at a single version of a function, but still using lazy initialization. And here we wrote specific checkers on top of our tool, including a leak checker, an uninitialized data checker, and a user input checker. And these checkers are essentially like Valgrind, but apply to all execution paths and considering all possible input values. And so we evaluated our checkers on over 20,000 functions from bind, OpenSSL, and this time the Linux kernel. And we found 67 new bugs, including 37 memory leaks, 19 uses of uninitialized data, and 11 unsafe uses of user input. And this user input checker is one exception to what I said earlier, where our tool doesn't specifically look for exploitable bugs. We wrote this one checker that specifically looks at inputs that come from the outside world, network inputs, system call arguments, these sorts of things, and specifically tries to identify when these are used in an unsafe way. And we did find one bug in a VMware driver where it does an unchecked memcopy length that looks a lot like the Heartbleed vulnerability from 2014. And when we manually ran our tool on a version of OpenSSL that had Heartbleed in it, it did correctly detect that vulnerability. So I've described under-constrained symbolic execution, and I've gone over two use cases that we describe in the paper, including equivalence checking in the context of patches, as well as general bug finding using these rule-based checkers. I've also summarized some of our experimental results on bind, OpenSSL, and Linux kernel. And at this point, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Jeff Canning, Harvey Mudd College. So this is obviously really nice for finding bugs in shipping code, but I had another use case that popped into my mind when you mentioned Valgrind, because when you're teaching C and C++ to students, They just have a hell of a time. And, you know, Valgrind helps, but it's not really great. How easy would it be to use this in that kind of environment to help students deal with their pointer problems?
So I think for most student code, it's probably simple enough that you might want to run just a normal symbolic execution tool, like the baseline CLI tool. Where our system excels is sort of these larger code bases where you have shipping code and just a straightforward symbolic execution tool kind of fails based on scalability limitations. When you run this tool, you are going to deal with false positive issues, which are probably going to confuse your sort of introductory students, I think.
Yeah, thanks.
Austin Clements, Google. First, you should be using Go. I was wondering, when you dereference an unbound pointer, how do you know what type to allocate?
So we treat all of our memory objects as untyped. Actually, we do store some type information just to make the outputs for our error messages more readable. But in terms of the mechanics of how our tool works, it doesn't know the type.
Okay. Does it allocates what size it is?
For several years of this paper, we did have this whole technique for guessing sizes and backtracking to sort of revisit that decision and make a larger object. But now we actually have symbolically sized objects. So we set some maximum bound, like 25 kilobytes, which is huge for most mallocs. And then we just use that as a symbolic size and do all the mechanics using that.
Hi, my question is, CLI is to symbolically execute the whole program. You just to execute one function directly. So how to model the environment of the this function? Mm-hmm. And there are some dependence of the between the functions.
Yes, so CLI itself does come with a fairly basic model of certain POSIX system calls. We kind of rewrote that from scratch with this tool. So there is some dependency when you do call outside functions. And there are certain cases where you're calling functions that exist in third-party libraries that are only in binary format, for instance, and our tool, since it runs on essentially source level, can't support those functions. So there are certain things that we just simply can't support with this tool.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, one more question.
I have a question about how you're handling the symbolic execution, actually. And you started the symbolic execution from a function, so that interest. So where do you stop the symbolic execution?
So we stop either when we run out of paths because we exhausted all paths, or more commonly, when you hit some time bound. So we say, run a particular function for an hour, and after an hour, just stop.
So it's just a timeout, like you said, some period of time, if it runs out and the symbolic execution doesn't terminate, so just stop it, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, so that is essentially the main scalability limitation with symbolic execution, is just that there's just an intractable number of paths through non-trivial code. So you could run it forever, but usually you stop it at some point.
Okay. Second question. CLI, I know CLI requires the use of micro library. It's not this standard libc mm-hmm. memory.
Right.
So it's a bit different when you run this real application in the environment, when you compile it, use LVM, and then run it again. And in a symbolic scheme, how do you handle this?
So we also use UCLibc instead of glibc, mostly because we found that after a significant effort, it was still basically impossible to compile glibc using LLVM into bitcode, at least the versions that existed at that point. One of the caveats that we do describe is that it is subject to a particular compilation. So this includes different compile time options, either in the code you're checking, or in the libc you're using, or in the system models that you've written. Ideally, UCLibc and glibc both respect their respective standards. So hopefully the program's behavior doesn't depend on any particular behavior that's exhibited by one version of the C library. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let's thank David again. Yeah, so maybe you can take it offline.
Can I ask?
question?
Okay, if it's a quick one, sure.
Okay. Hi, Endadul Haq from Purdue. One question is that, let's say you said that for a pointer, you allocate a memory, and that's you don't know exactly, and you allocate a chunk of memory for that. Mm-hmm. If it is the pointer is using, for example, like in real program for a buffer, it's just incrementing. In your case, if you're allocating for a large chunk, you don't know exactly the size of the buffer, and you may, I mean, in your with your technique, can you think that you will be able to detect the out-of-bound memory error in that case?
Yes, so as I mentioned, we sort of reserve, that's a better way to put it, I think, we reserve a large chunk of memory, but we set the size of that to be some new symbolic value. So we say this is X bytes. We don't actually say it's 100 bytes. So every time you read from this buffer, we'll actually consider a case where the buffer where X is smaller than the offset that you're reading from, and we'll actually emit an error in that case.
Okay.
So essentially, as you're reading more and more bytes from this, we'll sort of implicitly increase the bound of that object just based on the constraints that get added.
Okay. Thanks.